I'm Joe Eberson. I teach biblical studies at California Lutheran University. My home is in Zumbrota, Minnesota, and I've lived in California for 2 years. And as kind of a keynote getting into the book of Jeremiah, I would like to raise that question with you. I'd like each of you to say your name and where you are from and where you feel at home. And I do that simply to lead into the prophetic imagination, because when we study the book of Jeremiah, it is very clear right away that the prophet does not feel at home where he lives. The prophet feels at home in the Lord. And tomorrow I will bring the little book by Gerhard Frost, Homing in the Presence, because I think it speaks so clearly to Israel's prophetic tradition. The prophet has the vision of God's throne room and feels called by God, and that's where he takes his drumbeat for living, from his home. But just to get into this a little bit, as others are coming in, just come up here and fill in any place around the side here. Where are you from? What is your name? Where are you from? And where do you feel at home? The basic characteristic of the prophet of ancient Israel is that he is at home in the Lord. Isaiah says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And the Lord said, who will go and who will speak for me?" And with fear and trembling, we hear the response of the prophet Isaiah, "Here am I, send me." And that vision of heaven is like the marching orders, like having your orders cut in a military environment. You're being sent. And we see that characteristic in Amos and in Hosea, Micah, Isaiah, and certainly in the prophet Jeremiah. Not exactly a willing soldier, not exactly a willing messenger of the Lord, but one who was overwhelmed by a sense of conscience and intellect to use all of his energy to serve his Creator, the Lord. Talk about one, begin with God. That's what you see in Jeremiah. And that becomes kind of the focal point for understanding life and his ministry in the world, what he is to do with his life, wherever he happens to live. He's at home in the Lord. I'm from Zumbrota, Minnesota. Our family only lived there 8 years, but I went through that time from about fifth grade through high school and kind of got launched into college at St. Olaf, not far away in Northfield, Minnesota. And then off to the seminary, and 2 years in West Germany, and then 3 years of doctoral study in Richmond, Virginia, and we lived 7 years in Decorah, Iowa, where I taught at Luther College, and 15 years in St. Paul, Minnesota, in St. Anthony Park, and teaching just off of, or serving a church just off of White Bear Avenue. So I went Highway 36 every day back and forth for 15 years. And now suddenly, 2 years in Southern California. And those of you from Minnesota know, because you're so built in, the ideology of Minnesota says that, how can anyone live in California? And we had to deal with that ourselves, moving from Woods Indians and black earth and the love of lakes. I was down yesterday on Lake Chelan. I realized how much I even miss lakes here. You must hike to Holden Lake or the other lake if you're from Minnesota here, because you need to see lakes. We need that in our blood. But the hardest thing for me moving to California was moving from black dirt to desert. And Thousand Oaks, California is 50 miles north and west of LA. Minnesotans don't even think you can go west from LA. You can go 100 miles west of LA to Santa Barbara, but it's all desert. Terrain, not the Oxnard Plain, but up in the hills, it's all desert, and it was a terrible shock to my system. I have not been at home yet in California. It's coming. We bought a house, and I'm slowly getting a home in California, But the other thing we've realized is that our daughter, who is now 21, was 4 years old when we moved to Minnesota. And she lived in the same house, the same bedroom, the same dog, the same cat for 15 years. The cat was actually 15 and the dog was 13 last year when she was put to sleep. But that much security, one neighborhood school. And we have really recognized a price that she has paid as we have done what secular Americans do. We just pull up the rug and sell everything and move to a whole new environment in California. We've been very much aware of home and loss of home. One of the themes that I would like to focus on this week as we look at the prophet Jeremiah is the question of land. And that's very much like home. Homeland. What is your home? What does it involve? Particular real estate? Does it involve ownership? What's in your head if you bought and paid a huge amount of money and now the society tells you your land isn't worth very much, especially if you're a farmer? Or what kind of feelings do you have in your head if you buy very low and now suddenly somebody else tells you your land is quadrupled in value? How come it is that the society in one situation can give you such a depressed feeling, my land isn't worth very much? Or on the other hand, if it was just very cheap and now the world tells you this land is worth four times as much, it's still the same house, it's still the same property, and who is to say that next year the bottom might fall out and what was very valuable becomes very poor again? The Bible is asking questions about the earth, it says, belongs to the Lord. And in a sense, in biblical faith, we are all sojourners. We are all travelers. We can be at home anywhere because our home is in the Lord, so we can live almost any place. That's very biblical, that we are but travelers here. Heaven is our home. And that's a concept in the prophets that we need to see right from the outset. That vision of heaven is something that is in Isaiah or Jeremiah's mind. And it's a vision of how the world holds together in the oneness of God. We aren't just talking about a place beyond death. In fact, I have contended in another setting that heaven, the vision of heaven, may be the most central and the most important biblical concept. Not as a place, not as a place after death, but as a symbolic vision of how the world holds together. When I say heaven is my home, I'm but a traveler here, I'm but a sojourner here. It's my relationship to the symbolic unity that I find in the governance of God. And to do that, in a sense, the Bible is like a history of God's dealings with people. In that sense, almost a roadmap of understanding how people have understood the God of Abraham and Sarah, the God of Moses, who gives us the memory of Exodus and the Ten Commandments, and the history of David and the kings, and the way God has dealt with the people of Judah, people of faith, and how it is focused for Christian people in the early church's memories of Jesus of Nazareth, whom they say is more than a prophet, and so they have to use Messiah language to declare this one is like the focal lens. This one is Messiah for us in deciding what we think God is like. Heaven is our home in that sense. I forgot the book that I've been using as a keynote in this series, these 2 weeks, by Gerhard Frost. It's a little book called Homing in the Presence, or another one. I've been using a kind of a keynote each day. And the keynote that I intended to use today is his little poem on being at home, what it means to be at home. And I don't remember all of that poem, but I just remember enough of it to quote part of it. Home, he says, is where there's always a place to hang your hat. Home is where you are expected. Home is where you can undress. Home is where you're comfortable with a bed and a chair and a place. And then what I really like, he says, home is where you can always let down whatever is holding you up, or let out whatever is holding you in. And it's where you can feel at home. Where you can say whatever's on your mind, and people aren't going to jump all over you. Think of that in the context of faith. I think that's the way faith ought to be, that we're at home in the realm of faith. Obviously, I recommend so highly the Book of Psalms, because the Psalter is like the hymn book of home, of our home faith, being at home. And it's so beautiful that the Psalms include both laments and hymns of praise. And that depends on how you feel. And the one thing you do at home, you don't fake it. When you're at home with trusted people, you tell it like it is. And if the day requires that you bitch and gripe and complain a little bit, then that's what you do. And that's what those laments are all about, both in the Book of Lamentations and in the Book of Psalms. One of the things that puzzles me is that people of faith sometimes get so phony about lamenting. They don't think it's appropriate, like God will be angry if I lament or complain. That is certainly not the Book of Psalms or the Book of Lamentations. If that's the way you are feeling, then you pour out your lament, your complaint, your concern to the Lord, like a home family member, like a loving parent. You say, this has been a horrible day, and especially when tragedy strikes. It's appropriate to pour out your lament like you would in the security of your own home. And the wondrous thing is, on a beautiful morning like today, where we've had rain for 2-3 days here, and I wake up this morning and suddenly I feel new energy, then this is like a day of praise for me. I don't know what it is for you, but today is a very good day for me. I had a little froggy throat and I'm feeling better. And so today is a day when I can honestly say, this is the day which the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad. Or I can say, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Doesn't belong to me. It doesn't belong to the Forest Service. What's so nice here is that this land that we're on honestly belongs to all of us, because the U.S. Forest Service is just holding it in trust for all of us. And that's kind of fun, that this is our land, it's your land, it's my land. But we'll talk more about that this week. Now, the setting for this study of Jeremiah, which makes it, I think, a little bit unique from what you may have done before, that I'm suggesting, is that perspective of exile. I would like to suggest that we read this week in the book of Jeremiah together from the perspective of that time in ancient Israel when the people had lost their land, when they were no longer there. Those of you who know something about Old Testament history know that the dates are 587 to 539, 500 years before the time of Jesus, an era in Old Testament history that we call the Babylonian captivity or the exile. In the year 587, Jerusalem was totally destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And when I teach Old Testament history, I say that these are the two most important dates, and I'm even going to quiz you before the week is over. 587 to 539, that much I'd like you to remember of history in Old Testament times. That date, 587, represents the absolute destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Judah as well, destroyed. The northern kingdom is already gone from the year 721, the 10 lost tribes of northern Israel. They're destroyed too. But this is the last remaining structure where people could claim ownership or being at home in their own land. And after 587, about 3,000 or 4,000, 5,000 people were shaved. Men and women had their heads shaved. They were roped together, and they were led off by the Babylonians around the Fertile Crescent, north through Lebanon, across Syria, and into what is today Iraq. And right near Baghdad, a little further, on the river Chebar, Tigris-Euphrates, they were set in work camps along the river, exiles from their home country. And it's there, in exile, that certain rabbis and priests emerge who bring together the memories of the prophet Jeremiah, who was back in Jerusalem, who lived through this whole era from 640 down to 580. Never went to Babylon, but he went with a few ragtag refugees from Jerusalem down to Egypt. And we think he died in Egypt about the year 580. But he lived through this whole era of the destruction of Judah and Jerusalem. And he wrote things down, or his scribe, his secretary, whose name was Baruch, B-A-R-U-C-H, Baruch wrote them down. We have all sorts of even evidence of how the words were written down, preserved in the book of Jeremiah. And those have all come together now to us, who are over in Babylon. Let's say it's about 560, 550, and we have been among the exiles in Babylon. And the memories of Jeremiah in written form are brought together into the book that we today know as the book of Jeremiah. Are you with me? That's where I want you to hear the message of Jeremiah. What we do know is that his words were true about Jerusalem, because he predicted and warned that the way the people were living and the policies of the kings, Jehoiakim and Zedekiah, these last two kings, were absolutely disastrous for the people. Poor political leadership, unthinking, short-sighted politics that brought the downfall of their country. That has all happened now. It's not a question of whether or not how he knew. We can ask that question, but the fact is we have the advantage of hindsight, because we know that what Jeremiah said came to pass. And that was the test of true and false prophecy. And his words have all come to pass now. And the question is, how do we hear his words back then from the perspective of Babylon? Okay? Now, loss is very much on our minds as exiles. I want to suggest five ways, and then we'll look at a text in Jeremiah 29, which is a letter to us in Babylon. But we're sitting in Babylon, and we are really not sure what to believe or to think or how we should live, because all that's on our mind is loss. And I want to suggest five ways in which loss takes place. First of all, it's simply the loss of land. All those beautiful memories of our home are gone. It's like having your street and your town paved over for a superhighway or something. It's gone. The villages are destroyed. So there is no more land. We are landless people. We are pilgrims. And it isn't even that I chose to go from Minnesota to Thousand Oaks because of a job and pull factors and some other things. It's the fact is that I was pushed out of my land. I'm a refugee. I'm a Cambodian. I'm a Hmong. I'm a Southeast Asian who was pushed out from the aftermath of war, and I've come here whether I like it or not. That's my situation. So it's loss of land and all the grief that goes with that. Secondly, it's loss of the city. Jerusalem had a very special place as the capital city of Judah. I think of New Yorkers who are so provincial. I guess LA people can be too, and maybe people in your town can be, where you see your hometown as the center of the world. I've seen that famous New York map. New York City is pictured with Broadway and all the rest of it, and then out west is Syracuse, New York, and Western New York, and just beyond it is California. And it's really like there's nothing else in between except the Pacific Ocean beyond. And you see the kind of self-centeredness of New Yorkers. That's the way Jerusalem people were. We call it Jerusalem theology, City of God theology. And if you go to the next session this morning to study Augustine, you know he wrote the famous book, The City of God. That all is born of the prophetic theology, Isaiah and Jeremiah, talking about the city, and Isaiah especially wants to liken the city to the world. And all the inhabitants who are in the city are the inhabitants of the world, or the church gets likened to the city of God, Jerusalem, in your head. Well, that's all gone too, because the city wall was torn down and all of the houses were burned. So all of that meant all of the promises to Jerusalem, to Zion, are gone. Thirdly, the temple is gone. And this really gets touchy now, because there was in Hebrew tradition, from Solomon on, the religious belief that God commanded Solomon to build the temple as his own dwelling place on earth. And according to the priests, God said, "There I will dwell forever in my house, in the central temple in Jerusalem, in the Holy of Holies." So put the two tablets of the Ten Commandments in the Ark of the Covenant behind the curtain in the Holy of Holies, and only the priest shall go in there, and then only once a year, the most sacred place on earth. Why? Because there God promised unconditionally, the priest said, to meet people. Sound familiar? That's where we get Eucharist theology. That's where the Catholic Church gets Mass theology. We call it Catholic substance, the notion that in a special way we meet God and we encounter God in the sacrament, different even than from preaching or from the Word, that there's something unique. That's Mass theology, Catholic substance, or priestly theology related to the temple. That's where it's born, is that God can meet us in a special way, in a special place. Not God of the golf course, no. That's Protestant principle. God is everywhere. But Catholic substance says in a particular way, in the Mass, in the bread and the wine, we can encounter God, because God promises that. And the people had believed that. And ruthless, young, barbarian men from Edom and Babylon came into the temple, and they didn't give a damn about the religious piety of the people, and with their swords and weapons they smashed everything to bits. Or if anything had gold and silver in it, they carried it off as plunder. How come God didn't strike them dead? That would be our thought as we sit in Babylon. You see how that gets crushed? It's gone. Land, city, temple. It's all gone. And there's another, fourth area that's very touchy, because it involves the king. We had wanted a king back in 1000 BC. We wanted to be like the other nations. And so we really asked God to give us a king, because all the other nations had kings. And after Saul, David, and Solomon, we dreamed of the day when there would be another king like David, a son of David. This, of course, is the Christ tradition. This is the Messiah tradition. We had hoped that another good king would come like David. We thought maybe Josiah would be that. He was so good. But in the year 609, he went out to lead the army out at Megiddo, and he was cut down like any other ordinary soldier, killed in battle at the hill of Megiddo. Do you know what that is? Armageddon is the pass at Megiddo. And Josiah's gone. He's dead like any other human being, not the Messiah. And now you get two very horrible kings. And in the year 587, you can read this in Jeremiah 39 or in 2 Kings 24, the story is told with vivid description how Zedekiah tried to escape. 18 months under siege. And Zedekiah took a party of about 50 horsemen, and he tried to flee down to the Dead Sea to get away from the Babylonians. They caught him. And with his sons, they brought him to a place called Riblah. Very descriptive. They built a bonfire, put a huge metal rod into the fire, and let it turn red hot. And then in a very formal ceremony, they line up Zedekiah's sons in front of him, and one after another they kill them with a sword, so that the king has to witness the death of his sons. And then they take the metal rod and they put out Zedekiah's eyes. They don't kill him. It's just like chess. That's where chess comes from, the old notion that you don't kill the king. When the king is trapped, the game is over. But you don't even kill him. I mean, the king is sacrosanct. And all throughout the ancient Near East, that was the goal. Capture the king. Or if you do kill him accidentally, you return his bones to his own people, because he's symbolically the presence of God in their midst. Zedekiah, in 587, blinded, is also roped and taken over to Babylon. There was a boy king in 598. Jehoiakim had also been deported. He was only 18 years old and succeeded his father Jehoiakim, but they deported him in 598, and it was the Babylonians who had actually appointed Zedekiah. And now he's gone too. And so we who are sitting in Babylon have no messianic hope, because the only heirs to the throne are sitting like captives in Babylon. Kingship is gone, destroyed. The whole heritage from David, over 500 years, is gone. And in this depressing litany of loss, there's one other factor, and it's probably the most critical. With all of that sense of loss, we are caught in the secular world of Babylon, which says that what happens on earth is really just a reflection of what is going on in heaven. In the ancient Near East, we call that the principle of divine correspondence. What happens on earth is really just a reflection of what's going on among the gods, and it's polytheism. There are many gods. But when the king of Judah is blinded and taken as a captive to Babylon, that means that Yahweh, the God of Judah, has also had his hands at least tied, or maybe he's been blinded too. And Yahweh, the God of Jews, or Judah, has also been taken into captivity by the great gods of Babylon. Do you follow me? That's divine correspondence. It's what is happening on earth reflects what's going on in heaven.
So that's number five.
That's number five. And I think we would almost have to say it's like the death of God. It's like the question, does God have any power? Has our God been made powerless? You see how the whole religious system is threatened. And it's rather modern, because it's asking, is anybody out there? Is there anyone out there who can help us? Or is God simply absent or powerless? And I would contend for those of us in Babylon, when the book of Jeremiah is written down, that is the critical question. What can we trust? Can we trust anything? And lo and behold, here come some leaders of our people who are saying, you know, we should have listened to Jeremiah. We should have listened to him back then. The people didn't in Judah. But what is clear as a bell is that Jeremiah evidently was reading the world right, because the very things that he warned about happened. Painful, terribly painful, to ask, how could he be saying those things? And what he's saying that is so offensive is that God was threatening to punish his own people. And that really puzzles us. Is God still a God of love? Is God still for us? And I would contend that that is also what Jeremiah was saying. That's also preserved for us. That they're saying, well, remember, Jeremiah didn't just speak horrible words of judgment on the people of Judah. Way back, he was also giving words of encouragement to people in exile. He was saying, there's a way to live with God that you can trust. And that's what I want to do. I want to have us look together at chapter 29 of the book of Jeremiah, because preserved in these writings is a letter that Jeremiah sent to exiles in Babylon. Chapter 29, we're going to look at the first 7 verses or so. And I invite your questions, your comments, your reactions. I hope each of you have a copy of Scripture. There are more there. Maybe anyone else who doesn't have a copy? And would you bring another one, please? You've got them in the balcony? Okay. Chapter 29 of Jeremiah as kind of a keynote to our study this week of the message of the prophet Jeremiah. Will someone read for me? Volunteer to read? Will you read, please? Chapter 29.
These are the words of the letter which Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the elders of the exiles, and to the priests, the prophets, and all the people, whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. This was after King
Jeconiah
and the queen mother, the eunuchs, the princes of Judah and Jerusalem, the craftsmen, and the smiths had departed from Jerusalem.
Okay, I'll just stop there a minute and comment. What do you hear him saying? This, according to the memory now, this has been preserved in writing, and we in exile have this. It's a memory way back here of 598. All right? The first deportation, when the queen mother and this guy Jeconiah, In Deuteronomy, he's known as Jehoiakim, C-H-I-N. The 18-year-old boy had just become king, and that's when the Babylonians came the first time. The problem? Jehoiakim had tried to withhold taxes. It's a tiny little vassal country, and it's a vassal to the empire, Babylon. And he was withholding taxes. Now, I kind of understand that. Why should he send taxes to the emperor? What has the emperor done for me lately? The empire. It wasn't fair. And so all of the patriotic urges in the time in his kingdom or in his advisors, they said, I don't think we need to send the taxes. Or they're unfair. They're too high. And in retaliation, Nebuchadnezzar came and said, all right, it's too late. We're going to take tribute. And they came in, and we hear that they plundered the temple and the palace. In other words, they were bought off. They didn't destroy the city. But Nebuchadnezzar also took about 400 or 500 people. And it says who they are here. The letter to the people had been taken after, that's Jehoiakim, King and the queen mother, the court officials, the leaders of Judah and Jerusalem, the artisans, the blacksmiths. That's so interesting. Really a high prestige job in an era where horses and armies were everything. You take the blacksmiths because they are very important to you. The smiths and had departed from Jerusalem. So we know this is after 598. Any other question or comment about this? A letter sent from Jeremiah, who's in Jerusalem, is remembered, a letter that was sent to exiles in Babylon. Questions?
Yes, who would be the elders of the exiles? Who would they be?
I think they would be anyone who had government positions. He came in and took out the whole government and the king and just deposed them all. In other words, it clearly was military occupation for a while by the Babylonians. Kind of like us taking out Noriega, I suppose. I mean, I think you almost have to think in those terms. The United States and Puerto Rico, Bahamas, Mexico, the little countries that are economically dependent on the U.S. It's kind of like that. Whatever it's the justice issues that are involved, or the empire had its own view of reality. And in Babylon's mind, this was a rebellious little country, maybe not smuggling drugs, but a thorn in the side. If they withhold their taxes, so will everybody else. We've got to show them a lesson. We've got to make an example. So they come in and they take out the elders and the leaders. Other questions? Understand what's going on? I mean, lots of justice questions or right and wrong questions come to your mind here. But what is it now that Jeremiah does, and how does he get the letter along? It's really a sermon that he's sending, because he's kind of a preacher, and he sends a letter along with two court officials or two new state officials who are on their way to Babylon. Does he smuggle it along? I don't know. You can tell me what you think as you read it. Go on, please, and read for me the next verses. Verse 3.
Yeah. The letter was sent by the hand of Elisha, the son of
Shaphan,
and Gamariah, the son of
Hilkiah,
whom Zedekiah, the king of Judah, sent to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon.
Okay, that explains it, that this was, he sent the letter along with an official envoy. When the boy king, Jehoiakim, 18 years old, was deported, the Babylonians appointed his uncle and named him Zedekiah, gave him a new name. That's easy for you to remember. The last king of Judah begins with Z. The last king of Judah before 587 is Zedekiah. You should remember that. And he's appointed by the Babylonians, and so he's in correspondence with Nebuchadnezzar. You know, like the king or the president of Haiti corresponding with the president of the United States. It's that kind of a relationship. And he sends it, we hear, by the name of, with two people whose names are preserved, Elisha and Gemariah. The only reason I pause for that is we're going to see, as we read carefully in Jeremiah, that the Shaphan family was very sympathetic to Jeremiah. And my teacher, John Bright, used to talk about, the Shaphan boys are always bailing Jeremiah out of trouble. That's the way he'd talk. And you find that, the Shaphan boys, there are three of them, all are sons of Shaphan, who had been Secretary of State under Josiah. And they seem to have a certain respect or awe for the prophet Jeremiah. There's a division within the cabinet of Zedekiah. They aren't all pro-king and anti-Jeremiah. It's political intrigue, okay? So these two guys, I think, smuggle along secretly a letter from Jeremiah to the exiles. And this is what the letter says. And I'm suggesting this might be a keynote within the book of Jeremiah for those of us who are in exile. Okay? We read on.
Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease.
Okay, we stop there a moment, and you tell me what advice is Jeremiah giving to these people who have been deported to Babylon in 598?
Make this your home.
What?
Make this your home.
Make a home there, huh? What else do you hear?
Get on with your usual life.
Get on with life. What else?
Lots of children so that they can overcome, I think, to build in numbers, to build strength.
Don't decrease, he's saying, increase in numbers.
Like the Mormons want to have lots of children, or the Catholics did, so that they...
Any immigrant group, he's saying, don't hold back, build the community.
So they wouldn't be a minority, they'd become a, could become a majority.
I don't think he's going that far, but he's saying, at least don't die out.
He does not say, however, take wives and so on among your own people.
I know it. Very interesting that this isn't very defensive. Ezra would say, be sure that you only intermarry among the Jews, among your own kind. Ezra would have that kind of mood. I guess I have to be fair to think Jeremiah is saying that the letter is to the exiles, that it's, well, he doesn't say, be careful not to intermingle with the Babylonians. The whole mood here is, don't be afraid. And you get the feeling, and this is what's underlined here, it may be a long time, folks. That's what I think Jeremiah is saying. It may be a long haul. And frankly, to jump ahead a little bit, I think that's born of the fact that Jeremiah is just as pessimistic about Zedekiah as he was about Jehoiakim. There ain't much good going on here at home, folks. The political situation still looks very bad. It could be a long time before you're going to be allowed to come home. So make the best of it. Do you hear the kind of, this is compromise, it's pragmatism, it is not some soaring idealism at all here. Jeremiah is saying, make the best of it, folks. Plant gardens, eat their produce. Give your children in marriage. Take daughters in marriage or sons. Don't decrease, increase. Interesting word of counsel to them. And we're going to end here in just 5 minutes, but I'm suggesting that the next verse may be one central keynote for understanding the message of the prophet Jeremiah. Would you read verse 7?
But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare.
What do you hear in that? Seek the welfare of the city where you are living, for in its welfare you will find your own. I find it kind of overwhelming. This is a written record preserved from the prophet Jeremiah before the fall of Jerusalem, way back in 598. That's what he was telling exiles. Live as people of faith. Trust the Lord. But don't be afraid of the fact that you're in a foreign land or in an exiled situation. Bloom where you are planted. At least for me, this is very meaningful today, and I think you see it's preserved in the canon because it had meaning for successive generations of people. Bloom where you are planted, even if you don't feel totally at home, or even if you have no home. Bloom wherever you happen to be, even in the woods at Holden Village. Because God is with you. Portable religion is born in the Babylonian captivity. And the promises of God are still to you if you trust in God. It is possible, we know that people could turn against God and God punished them. In fact, God destroyed his own land, which means that the Lord of heaven and earth is evidently not bound up my country right or wrong, my land right or wrong. It's very comforting to me because in these first couple of years in a whole new land of Southern California, I have not felt at home. But as a person of faith, I know that my marching orders are to seek the welfare of the Kineo Valley where I am now living. And wow, are there needs in that secular, urban, anonymous world of California. And I believe that the word of the church is very needed. There are all sorts of other things that go through my mind here. The memory of the Jerusalem can be discerned. You know, little countries and even empires in biblical faith rise and fall. And what is so intriguing there is that Judah really came apart by internal decay, by the short-sightedness of her own political rulers. The memory of Assyria, the first world empire, is the same. It came apart internally. And we look at the rise and fall of nations and empires, and I ask, will the United States last forever? If you look at the sweep of history and the rise and fall, and we have just witnessed the incredible fall of the Soviet Union, primarily, am I right, from internal decay, not from external threat. And I look at our national debt, $4 trillion, or I look at other unemployment problems and I ask about internal decay. When the prophets measure the health of a society, they see the king and the priests and the wealthy at the top. And down at the bottom, economically, they see the poor and the needy and the oppressed. And they see the orphans and the widows and the sojourners. The sojourners are the aliens or the refugees. And it is in the prophetic mind that if you want to take the temperature or check the health of a country or a society, the place to put the thermometer in is down at the bottom. Kind of looking at a society from the bottom up, says the prophet. My teacher James Mays has written about Amos. It is through the eyes of the poor that God sees the world, because their situation reveals most clearly the patterns of greed and the patterns of selfishness in a society. I don't know how you would measure the health of the United States at the present time, or the health of any country, but I do know that that's the prophetic way of looking at the world. And that's the way Jeremiah had looked at Judah when he said, Judah is a very sick country, and God is going to destroy it because you can't redeem it after Zedekiah. Now, I still contend that Jeremiah is a book of hope for people in exile. It's arranged like a pyramid, thematically, and that's why it's so hard. Don't try to read yet the first 20 chapters of Jeremiah. It's just too hard. You'll get too depressed. Start in the middle. And we actually think it's composed that way. The heart of Jeremiah is chapters 30 and 31, the little book of consolation. And like a house, we have a pyramid. It appears now that whoever organized the book put the hope section in the very middle and said that is what is most important for us as exiles. So let's close with one little word from that center section, which is really a word to exiles about the steadfast love of God for those who trust in Him. Can I have another volunteer to read? Chapter 30, verses 10 and 11, as a concluding note to our study today. Tomorrow we're going to look at the confrontation between Jeremiah and Hananiah, chapters 27 and 28. If you want to read, start with chapter 26 and read on through to 45, the book of Baruch, Jeremiah's scribe. 26 up to 30, 45, even if you just read a few chapters. Read from 26 on. It's historical narrative, tells you pictures of Jeremiah's life. But this little word from the centerpiece as we close, Jeremiah 30, verses 10 and 11.
Then fear not, O Jacob, my servant, says the Lord, nor be dismayed, O Israel. For lo, I will save you from afar, and your offspring from the land of their captivity. Jacob shall return and have quiet and ease, and none shall make him afraid. For I am with you to save you, says the Lord. I will make a full end of all the nations among whom I scattered you, but of you I will not make a full end. I will chasten you in just measure, and I will by no means leave you unpunished.
You see, there's a way in which the proof of prophecy is you can trust the words of Jeremiah to be true because what he said about the judgment of Jerusalem came to pass. And suddenly, that becomes a very encouraging thought. Can we also trust these words to be true? And that becomes an enormous word of hope and courage in exile. Thank you for today. See you tomorrow. Thank you.